I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. I'm Mary Garofalo, and I'll be your worship associate today. Our minister, Reverend Day, is off this morning. Christopher McCloskey is our guest speaker and worship leader. Dr. Christopher McCloskey is a professor of English in Savannah. He holds a bachelor's degree in physics and English from Catholic University of America, an MA in literature and language from Marymount University, and a doctorate in English from Louisiana State University. As a scholar, he studies, teaches, and writes on crime fiction in all its media forms, especially in terms of adaptation. In particular, he explores how American cultural narratives are propagated through adaptation, integrating how American identities are formed and transformed globally, particularly through gaps between individual, social, and state definitions of American identity. He also examines and works at the intersection of science and humanities. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all race, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be and whoever you are on your journey. With the lighting of the chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. As we light this chalice, may all who gather here be filled with joy and hope, filled with compassion and love, so that we may pour ourselves out into the world. I have two pieces to read to you. The bead of sticky mango juice running down my bony wrists. It is the Indian girl next door who wears the same two dresses all year round. She gives me a ripe mango plumped to sweetness once a week. She never talks. She just gives me the mango and sits in the yard with a goofy smile, watching me as I eat it. And then she leaves. If she's trying to get me to like her, I can tell you right now, it's working. And the other one is, breathe in, breathe deeply, breathe in love. It is love, all this that surrounds you perfectly, touches you perfectly, holds you, contains you, fills you perfectly. You breathe it. You move through it. Everything you see through it. It is given. Breathe into you the breath of love from the divine lungs that breathe everything, that have been breathing from all eternity, breathing the one spirit we all breathe. Breathe it in deeply, this love. Let it fill you, enliven you, change you, and breathe out.
Good morning, all. Thank you. I'm sure after my introduction, you were all worried that you were going to, hearing all of my academic credentials, that I was going to take you through a bunch of literary analysis and adaptation, and you kind of are. But actually, the reason that I think Reverend Lisa asked me to come here is that I helped start an advocacy group in Savannah a few months ago called Coastal Georgia for Democracy. You can learn about it at coastaldemocracy.org. And it's more in that capacity that I'm here. But I can't ever leave literature behind. So for the reading, I wanted to relate a story to you about a British suffragette that you may not have heard of, Lady Constance Bulwer Lytton. She's sometimes known as Constance Lytton or by her alias Jane Wharton. I discovered Constance Lytton when I was preparing a class focused on prison literature, since she authored an astounding memoir entitled Prisons and Prisoners. It's not very well known. I cannot recommend it enough. And in it, she prefaced it by saying, "Prisoners helped me. They seemed at times the direct channels between me and God himself, imbued with the most friendly and powerful goodness that I have ever met. Prisoners, I wish I could give to you for your joy something of the help you gave to me, and that in many ways I could follow your example." She wondered, in fact, what friendly thought could act beneficently for all prisoners? And there seemed this one thing: lay hold of your inward self and keep tight hold. Reverence yourself, be just, kind, and forgiving to yourself. Constance Lytton inspired me. I wanted to see humanity the way she did, wholly, gracefully, powerfully. In prison, where she willfully committed herself to force attention on the fact that women did not have the right to vote, Constance Lytton communed with her fellow inmates, some of whom were fellow conscientious objectors, were victims of patriarchal oppression, forced into conviction due to unfair application of the law, and some who were more direct violators of the law. One Sunday evening during some unusual festivities that the prison granted, that the prisoners told each other stories to pass the time and bind their community together. Emmeline Pethick Lawrence was the shining light of the evening, and she read from Olive Schreiner's Three Dreams in a Desert, an allegory Lytton had read many years before when it was first published. But for the remainder, I'm going to let Lytton reminiscence paint for us. I remember that the painter Watts and my father had been enthusiastic over the poetical beauty of these dreams. Their lyrical force, the imaginative woof and warp of their parables, and the dignified cadence of their language had impressed me in my youth, so that I read them many times for sheer emotional joy, but their meaning had evidently not penetrated to me. Olive Schreiner, more than any one other author, has rightly interpreted the women's movement and symbolized and immortalized it by her writings. Now, after even so short an experience of the movement as I had known, this dream seemed scarcely an allegory. The words hit out, a bare literal description of the pilgrimage of women. It fell on our ears more like an ABC railway guide to our journey than a figurative parable, though its poetic strength was all the greater for that. The woman wanderer goes forth to seek the land of freedom. How am I to get there? The old man, reason, answers, there is one way and one only. Down the banks of labor, through the water of suffering, there is no other. Is there a track to show where the best fording is, she asks. It has to be made. And she threw from her gladly the mantle of ancient received opinions she wore, as it was worn full of holes. And she took the girdle from her waist that she had treasured so long, and the moths flew out of it in a cloud. And he said, take the shoes of dependence off your feet. And she stood there, naked but for one white garment that clung close to her, the garment of truth, which she is told to keep. She is given a staff, reason, a stick that curled. Take this stick, hold it fast. In that day, when it slips from your hand, you are lost. Put it down before you. Where it cannot find a bottom, do not set your foot. The woman, having discarded all to which she had formerly clung, cries out, For what do I go to this far land which no one has ever reached? I am alone. I am utterly alone. But soon she hears the sound of feet, 1,000 times 10,000, and thousands of thousands, and they beat this way. They are the feet of those that follow you, reason says. Have you seen the locusts, how they cross a stream? First one comes down to the water's edge, and it is swept away. And then another comes, and then another. And at last, with their bodies piled up, a bridge is built and the rest pass over. She asks, and of those that come first, some are swept away and are heard of no more. Their bodies do not even build the bridge. What of that, reason says? They make a track to the water's edge. And in the last dream she sees in that land of freedom where love is no longer a child but has grown to a man, on the hills walked brave women and brave men hand in hand, and they looked into each other's eyes and they were not afraid. We dispersed and went back to our hard beds, to the thought of our homes, to the depressing surroundings of fellow prisoners, to the groans and cries of agonized women, content. As I laid my head on the rattling pillow, I surrendered my normal attitude towards literature and thought, there is some point, some purpose in it after all. It is quite easy to look around and get discouraged. Social media inflames our sense of hopelessness as enraging information and enraged takes flood our feeds. Wherever and whenever we work for justice and peace, waves of despair are coming to try to subdue us and lead us to give up. And you wake up and go to another meeting, see another enraging post, see the same injustice persisting, and ask yourself the natural question, is any of this making a difference? We're not so unique in this, though. Many before us have asked too, and frankly, often in worse circumstances. I think of John Brown and Harriet Beecher Stowe, moved by the continuing injustice of slavery, to just do something that would wake the country up. I think of Mother Jones, who lost everything in the Chicago Fire of 1871 and went on to suffer with pneumonia in prison on false charges while grieving the unjust deaths of striking workers, continuing to organize. I think of Frida Kahlo, debilitated by polio and injuries from a bus accident, celebrating Mexican identity in the wake of revolution and articulating queer identity in the face of a resistant world culture. I think of Socrates and Boethius, condemned unjustly to death but inspiring millennia with their philosophies. And I think of Dr. Martin Luther King and El Haj Malik El Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X, both of whom never saw the fuller fruition of their activism. And Constance Litton certainly asks, sitting in prison on hunger strike after years and years of broken promises by those in power. And women still couldn't vote. So Litton asked herself, is any of this making a difference? As I imagine was true of many of those before her, Litton was stirred and rejuvenated, not entirely from within, but also from without. Hearing Schreiner's words, not even for the first time, but at a moment when she really needed to hear them and was ready to really hear them, she was inspired to continue her fight in the face of overwhelming odds. Discouraged at first, she recommitted herself to her own fight, not because she looked around and saw things changing, but because she recognized the long tradition she existed in. She realized she needed to be the very example she was searching for. In Schreiner's allegory of the locusts, we experience the journey of generations working toward justice. After reason tells her to cast off the ancient received opinions she wore full of holes and the moth-filled undergarments and the shoes of dependence, she stands with only truth and a staff of reason. Reason explains to the wandering woman, first one comes down to the water's edge and it is swept away. And then another comes and then another. And we have no idea where we are precisely in the procession of locusts to the water's edge. Brown, Stowe, Jones, Kahlo, Socrates, Boethius, King, El Shabazz, and importantly, so many others like you and me and our friends and relatives whose name history has so far kept buried, we all do not know where we are in the procession to the water's edge. But as Schreiner tells us, at last, with their bodies piled up, a bridge is built, and the rest pass over. And it is a fraught moment. Schreiner does not shrink from it, nor should we. The pilgrim asks reason, her guide, and of those that come first, some are swept away and are heard of no more. Their bodies do not even build the bridge. That is the fear, isn't it? That our work won't even be remembered, that we'll be swept away without contributing anything. But reason consoles us. And reason consoled Lydden and the imprisoned women she was with that evening, enough that they went to sleep on hard beds amidst cries in the dark. They went to sleep content. Reason says, what of that? They make a track to the water's edge. Indeed, we may be swept away. My particular effort may not be the one that builds the particular bridge I would like to point to with pride. But some truly remarkable people have gone before us to lay a track to the water's edge, and we're living proof of their success without their efforts. Imagine the injustices we no longer have to live with. They succeeded. They didn't see that success, but we are proof of it. They showed others where to go and made it possible for the second and third and hundredth and thousandth locusts to show up and keep making that incremental progress. Laying the track to the water's edge and building that bridge, then, it looks like a lot of different things. It's not always glamorous, but it is always wondrous, necessary, and one in a long, long line of actions taken by genuinely heroic people, from the famous names to the ones who stood right next to them. It's the parent who has the difficult conversation about equity with their child, even when it's uncomfortable, maybe especially when it's uncomfortable. It's speaking up in a meeting when something unjust is said, even when it's uncomfortable, maybe especially when it's uncomfortable. It's showing up to the city council, to the protest, to the volunteer shift, again and again, even when it's uncomfortable, maybe especially when it's uncomfortable. It's the small act of kindness to someone society has discarded, even when it's uncomfortable, maybe especially when it is uncomfortable. But it's not always uncomfortable, and it might even be enjoyable. In the story earlier, Liam wasn't a gardener, but he knew that he could help. He messed up a bit at first, but he got better because he kept at it. And he didn't do it for any other reason than that it was the right thing to do. And when winter came and apparently ruined all of his progress, Liam stepped back to work with skills and with preparation that he shored up in the winter months. And he rejuvenated the gardens quickly. And his quiet lesson in gardening inspired many others to tend their own gardens until a once dismal city blossomed all over. When the woman cries, "I am alone, I am utterly alone," she hears something, the sound of feet, 1,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. We are never making the track alone. Others have come before us, the suffragettes, the civil rights marchers, the labor organizers, the quiet resistors whose names we'll never know. They made tracks so we could know where to step, and we could step and track like them. And behind us, can you hear it? The ones who will come after. They're watching how we move through this moment. They'll step where we step, and they'll make their own steps. When we despair, like those who came before, and we acknowledge that they suffered too, wondering what it was all for, we can look at ourselves with wonder and realize we are the answer to their questioning. You women who can vote are living proof of the belief Constance Lytton lived and died for. She died in 1923, 5 years before the UK finally extended the vote to all women over the age of 21. Lytton did not see that day, but she saw empowering glimpses of it. In 1918, before she died, the UK had extended the vote to women over 30. And in 1920, the US ratified the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, extending the vote to all women. And even then, there was work to be done to rid the US of the Jim Crow laws that suppressed the vote for black women. The Buddha's final words to his followers were, "Be a lamp unto yourself. Look for no other refuge." His example and of those I spoke of before helped build the good parts of the world we now inhabit. So we're privileged to be working on a world we may never see. Each step you take closer to the water's edge is living proof of the self-willed belief in humanity of those who came before. As Malik El-Shabazz said, "Tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today." You are living proof that this is Constance Lytton's day, Martin Luther King's day, your parents, and your grandparents, and your great-grandparents' day. Our day. to act as a benediction. The closing music is recorded music. I hope that will send us forth with hope for working on our own world.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.